Hello and welcome to the Right to Sonorable podcast, screaming into your internet echo chamber one painful episode at a time. My name's Jimmy and I voted to leave the EU in 2016.
And my name's Jazza, and while I've been planning a video based on the fantastic book by Sir Nick Clegg, How to Stop Brexit and Make Britain Great Again, I've been going back and re-watching some of my old videos from before the UK voted to jump off of a cliff and into an abyss of global prosperity and trade. And have been reliving all of the trauma that I felt back then. It's been fun. It's been great. I'm great. Everything's fine. I'm fine. Everything's fine. It's fine.
Okay, I'm fine. 2 points. 2 points.
I'm fine.
An abyss of global prosperity.
I'm fine. Yeah.
Does that work as a metaphor?
Is it ironic? I don't know.
Yeah, also, you're still on the Clegg book.
Yeah, no, I'm turning it into a video.
Oh, but...
I'm rereading it. It's my third time.
Your third time?
No, it's not. It's my second.
It's really not a very impressive book.
It's not really the kind of book that you pick up a second time and reread just for fun. But it is the type of book that if you're doing a review of the book, you should probably reread.
Not if you indexed it the first time around, like a sensible person.
I did index it, but not well.
Okay. It's a good job you're not doing some sort of degree that requires analysis of long texts.
I have no idea what you could possibly be talking about, Jimmy.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. What do we meet to do other than bitch at one another?
I mean, the more it goes on, the more it is just the bitching. But we also meet up weekly to talk about politics, social issues, and current events. This week, Trump sat down. Trump, he's the president, by the way. Anyone miss that?
Is it necessary to do that, strictly speaking?
I think, well, for posterity, just in case somebody picks up like an MP3 of this in the post-apocalyptic future, they need to know what kind of context we're talking about, you know.
That is true, yeah. There might be a second Trump who becomes president.
Ivanka. I am reading Fire and Fury at the moment, and apparently Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump have got a pact where she is going to be the one to run for the presidency first, apparently, and she's going to be the first female president.
Jesus.
Yeah. And it's in that book by what's his name? Wolf.
Michael Wolf.
Yeah, Michael Wolf. His name is. So it must be true.
Sure, must be true.
Trump sat down with a megalomaniac. Is it megalomaniac? No, he's just a egomaniac. That's the word. Piers Morgan, who will be known to American listeners for having his own show on CNN, where he was, I'm curious, and he was also the editor the Daily Mail in the United Kingdom up until
the 2000s. No. He was the Daily Mirror editor, not the
Was
Mail
it the
editor.
Mirror?
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah.
I don't think... Yeah, he's never edited the Daily Mail. That's... Yeah, sorry, I was just trying to check in my own head if that was true or untrue.
So, Piers Morgan is now with ITV and heads up a show called Good Morning Britain, which apparently he hates. But the two men, Trump and Piers Morgan, go back over a decade when Piers Morgan appeared on The Celebrity Apprentice and he won, I think? And
yes, he won.
Great. Great, what an achievement. That stands out in his CV. And this gets played up an awful lot in an interview that Trump and Piers Morgan did for ITV over the weekend, which is probably one of the worst pieces of journalism that I've ever seen. How about you?
Wow.
What did you think?
That's impressive. I haven't actually watched the whole thing. Is
that bad? Jimmy!
I've seen like news reports. I feel we can bring a diverse collection of views. You know, somebody who's actually seen the thing we're talking about and somebody who hasn't. So, you know,
well spun, Jimmy. Well spun. Our second topic is going to be. There's been some analysis leaked from the government around Brexit, and there are three possible plausible Brexit scenarios that I'm sure our listeners are going to be aware of. They include no deal, a comprehensive free trade agreement, and having a soft Brexit. The government has found out that Shock horror, this is probably going, all of these scenarios are probably going to reduce our growth by some percent. And everybody seems to think that this is a really big deal, despite the fact that before the referendum, every reputable economics house under the sun predicted these very same things. So I'm not sure what we take from this, Jimmy. Help me understand it as the man who made this happen.
The sole man who made this happen.
It is your fault.
Purely?
Yes.
That's quite impressive.
Mm-hmm.
I really should have bolstered my own CV.
You're an impressive man, Jimmy.
Thank you. Well, you're the one that I think suggested this topic, or did I suggest it? We both mutually agreed the topic, so I guess we must have thought there was something worth talking about.
Oh, fantastic. Are we going to get 15 minutes of white noise when we talk about this?
I mean, possibly, metaphorically, maybe.
Great. Can't wait. So that's going to be something for you to look forward to, listener. And then finally, Jimmy...
say there's like... I suppose it's interesting in the context of the calls for a second referendum, which we have previously covered. And also, it's another illustration of the general incompetence of the May administration. I guess we can... we can talk about it. I'm sure we can get something there.
I do just feel more and more sorry for Theresa May. And she becomes more and more like an underdog. And then I want her to succeed. Because she's the underdog. It's very confusing. I'm very conflicted about it. Jimmy, what's our final topic? This was your fault.
My fault.
Hmm.
So Jazza didn't, for some reason, that I assume that he will explain in due course.
Oh, you know very well.
For some reason, Jazza didn't want to do this. Basically, the darts in the UK is sort of like...
Is darts actually an international thing?
I don't know. But
does anyone else play darts?
Well, that's why I was going to like praise it and explain that, you know, people throwing like sticks at a you know, bit of cardboard on the wall.
That's that's a wonderful explanation of what darts is.
In Britain, this is a real sport, and people go to watch it. And kind of like in the F1 races, there are sort of, I don't know what you'd call them in a way that doesn't prejudice it one way or the other, but they're called walk-in or walk-on girls, which are kind of like glamour model type girls that sort of walk onto the stage with the men while looking hot. And
kind of like similar to, you know, in wrestling or boxing where there's the girls that hold up what round it is.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, similar to that kind of like a break between... I don't know, watching men throw sticks at a piece of cardboard.
Yes, and the main darts competition, PDC, has decided to stop utilising the services of these women, so effectively fired them, I suppose. It has been presented as a ban, but it's not really a ban, it's a commercial decision by a commercial organisation. Because they feel that it... I guess they must feel that it's generating too much bad press. But I thought this was interesting because there's sort of prompted debate as to kind of women's rights to take these jobs, because most of the women that actually do these jobs feel
point made
feel aggrieved that they can no longer take this work because it's no longer available, and then feminists on the other hand are saying that it was a terrible job in the first place and it shouldn't have existed.
Not all feminists, Jimmy. Just fine. Because there's been a few feminists on the TV who have said some things, they don't have like a committee meeting where they all go together and decide, oh, this is what the feminists think.
Sure. I mean, they should start doing that because that is how the patriarchy works, you know. Just better organised. Shall we play the music before I say anything else rude? Uh-huh. Now that you've made it through the intro, this is your regular reminder that we do have a Patreon account set up for anybody who wishes to support us and give some money towards the cost of hosting and various other things that make up the running costs of this show. If you want to support us, go to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. There you'll find all the information to give money to support the podcast, and you'll also see the various tiers of rewards available. As always, we want to shout out to Dominique Flood, Matt, Gemma Cumming, Agatha Hoder, and Ollie McGregor. Thank you all very much for continuing to support the podcast. So, Jazza, how do you feel about Piers Morgan?
You know, so I came to it. I think that this is a testament to my growing self-awareness. I worry that Piers Morgan and I actually have very similar interview styles.
Okay.
In that a lot of it is very much done through the lens of ourselves and kind of is jokey and chummy. And we're egomaniacs. The difference is I've never interviewed probably one of the most controversial people ever to have existed and made the first 15 minutes of said interview about me. And I'd like to think that I wouldn't do that if I had the chance to interview the president. But Piers Morgan just doesn't, for a journalist, he doesn't seem to be very good at his job, really, does he? What did you think? How much did you watch?
I've only seen clips, so I haven't seen the whole thing in the round.
Right.
But
the whole thing is bizarre. He kind of does, like, did you ever watch the Logan Paul video where he does, like, where he, like, goes up and talks about a dead body?
As we previously discussed, I've never seen Logan Paul. I'd never heard of him until
I'm not aware of his works. So at the beginning of that video, one of the things that he does is he says, guys, this is, like, probably one of the most craziest, the biggest things ever to happen on, like, YouTube, and this is, like, going to be so groundbreaking, it's going to be amazing because it's the first time it's ever happened. It's kind of actually Trumpian in the way he says that. Piers Morgan does this in his interview as well. It's like, this is the first time that Trump has ever spoken to a foreign media outlet. And, like, look, we used to be chums. Isn't this great? Nobody's ever had a chance to be able to talk to him like this before. This is going to be so candid. I'm going to be so rough. Oh, my God, it's going to be great. And it was really... It was such an odd tone to set. They are very clearly very similar men, and I can understand why they get on.
It's so odd. In what way are they similar men?
In that they both love each other. They love themselves.
But to be on TV generally, and they both are TV stars, I suppose.
Yeah, they are both TV people.
More than
yeah.
they are their other jobs, alleged jobs. you have to be kind of, you know, pompous and have a high opinion of yourself, don't you?
Yes, but I feel like there's meant to... You'll know this as a journalist. I feel like as a journalist, you're meant to... Yeah, like, there's meant to be a certain amount of rigour in the work that you do, and you're meant to be doing it in a certain way, and you're meant to, when you ask a question, perhaps follow up on that question. It was really odd also, Donald Trump walked in and said, I've missed you, how are you, my
yeah,
peers?
Yeah, I saw that.
That was just very, very odd.
But I suppose, in some ways, a lot of... I don't know if it's... to this extent in the US, but certainly in the UK, there are a lot of journalists and high-ranking politicians that are a lot more chummy than you might necessarily think, and that doesn't necessarily appear in their interviews and on camera, but it is true off camera and off the record, so to speak.
So I was thinking about this as well. Do you listen to the Nick Robinson podcast that he does?
Yeah,
so those are deliberately... Nick Robinson is a BBC political journalist, used to be the political correspondent, the political editor.
Editor, yeah.
He now has a podcast where he does, like, 30 to 40-minute long chats, like, more in-depth interviews with people from politics, like Ruth Davidson or Jess Phillips or whoever. And he clearly knows these people and likes these people and is able to have banter with these people, but is still able to do his job as a journalist. Mm. Whereas this Trump Morgan, which is what we were encouraged to tweet along at the time, this had all of the chumminess. It was brown nosing rather than any kind of chumminess, actually, I would say, on the on the part of Morgan. It was brown nosing and therefore was not able to have any kind of journalistic rigour. That didn't feel like two friends. That felt like a transactional relationship, and Morgan knew that he was, I mean, for want of a better word, the beta in that relationship.
It does kind of... The thing you said about the sort of the chumminess, there's... Have you listened to Matt Ford's podcast before?
No.
So Matt Ford is a British comedian who used to work for the Labour Party. And he does this podcast called The Political Podcast, and he has a show on Dave as well, which is...
Oh, an
like
upstanding
a...
network.
It's essentially a much shitter version of like the sort of live comedian TV shows they have in the States. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Matt Ford does a really good podcast called The Political Podcast, where he is actually, he's always very chummy with his guests, whether they be Nick Clegg or Nigel Farage or Tony Blair. Mm-hmm. And to be fair to him, he gets some really good stuff out of them. Like, he gets details out of them that I think it would be very difficult.
Yeah, it's a completely legitimate way to approach an interview.
Yes, that's all I would say. I'm not saying this applies to the Morgan interview.
Yeah, no, it 100% doesn't. Some of the things that were meant to be groundbreaking bits of information that we got from this, it looks like the actual interview itself was no longer than 30 minutes, so Morgan ended up interviewing Trump at the Davos... Is it a conference or a Davos...
That's the World Economic Forum, is the official name.
The Davos Forum. Yes. Correct. And they padded out, like... about 40 minutes of footage with an introduction, some stock footage, and some voiceovers by Piers Morgan himself. So I think he would have probably ended up with about half an hour. I understand that there's only so much follow-up that you can get in half an hour, but there was literally none. So when for example, Piers Morgan asked Trump if he's a feminist, and Trump goes... No, I wouldn't say I'm a feminist. That's too far. But I love women. I love men. I love each and every person. I need to stop trivializing him like this because it's actually terrifying.
I mean, what he said was, I love women, I love men, and I think you have to fight, or something like that, which is a bit of a non sequitur, but I guess what he's saying is...
Women don't fight for... They need to... Just try harder, women. That's what
like
you're
that.
Missing.
Yeah. I mean, that's reading between the lines. But to be honest with you, I don't even know how you interview someone like Trump, because everything he says is bollocks anyway. Most of it's gibberish. Most of it has no logical thread.
He very rarely finishes sentences.
Yeah, I mean, he often like pivots three or four times during the course of a sentence, which is quite impressive, even by most people's standards. Mm-hmm. I mean, have you actually seen an interview of him where you were like, oh, the journalist really got him there?
No, because people, even when journalists are trying to partake in rigorous interviewing, he is on. I'm not saying he's stupid, even though he is, but he functions on such a different plane to a normal human being. Do you know what I mean? So presenting facts to him and presenting data to him and drilling down on a topic doesn't work on him in the same way that it would with a normal human being. In kind of like a... In an even more extreme way, you know when you have like a nobody from the Ministry of Transport who's there to defend... like the hike in train fares with Jeremy Paxman, and they sit there and all they have been told is to just not answer the question. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like that, but there's no self-doubt in Trump whatsoever. Like, it's like, that's just where his mind goes. His mind completely ignores the fact that you've just accused him of something, or that he should probably defend himself or apologise. And then it just goes off into a different direction. There's one point where Piers Morgan seems to convince himself that Donald Trump has apologised to Britain about the retweeting Britain First, the far right anti-Muslim party. So Donald Trump a few months ago retweeted the they're hardcore racists.
As opposed to those softcore racists out there.
Yeah, they're not like your grandparents' racists. These are like hardcore hate anyone who isn't brown, who isn't white racists. And Trump was like, well, I don't know who they were, and they're not, this wasn't a big story in the US, so it doesn't matter. And then Trump goes, no, I really think that you should apologize. Trump goes, oh, well, then maybe that's something I would do if you thought I should apologize. But like I said, I don't know who they are. And then Piers goes, thank you, as if he's just apologized. But he hasn't apologized. You've managed to get him to get away with that. It's a little bit mad.
I mean, wasn't that... I don't know if it was a big story in the US, but it was reported on in the US, wasn't it?
It was 100... Yeah, no, it was definitely reported on in the US. Yeah. It did blow over because he probably did something else crazy the next day. But it was a huge... Like, it was a huge thing here. And also, if you're going to give a... if you're going to give an interview to a British broadcaster, then you should expect, something
British
like
questions.
That. Yeah, British questions, right? At least British-centric questions. Also, the fact that he talks about getting fan mail as a president. He said, I get fan mail from British people all the time. People in Britain love me. And to Piers' credit, he does keep on going, well, I'm not too sure about that, Donald. I'm not sure the UK is your biggest fan. And he's like, no, I get loads of fan mail. And I'm like, but I don't think presidents really... I don't think it's called fan mail.
Who sends letters anymore? That's a real question.
Yeah, also that.
I'm sure he does. There are people who like Trump in the UK. They're a minority, I hope. But there are. They do exist, at least on Twitter.
Yeah, but how many of them are there, Jimmy?
I don't know.
Not a lot. It was announced at Davos that Trump was... The state visit is now going to go ahead again, right?
Yeah.
So he was going to... He was meant to be coming and opening the new United States embassy in London. I believe next month or this month? February. And he... pulled out because he said that British people weren't hadn't learnt to love him yet, and which is, I mean, that's
sinister,
isn't it? Yeah, big time. And now he's apparently, Theresa May sat down with him again, and now he's going to have a state visit in October. So great, good. I'll just get my protest boots on for then.
I mean, do you think that some people have been threatening the biggest protest in British history over Trump's visit? Do you think it will pass the 1 million or so? Was it 1 million who turned up for the Iraq march?
Yeah, that's the biggest protest in a Western democracy on record, right?
I think the Women's March.
Do you think the Women's
January
March is now bigger? It was at the time anyway, right?
But that was in multiple cities across the US, so...
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it would easily be. It's gonna be a hoot. We're all gonna wear orange masks. Yeah, it's gonna be fantastic. I can't wait. An interesting thing at the end of the interview with Piers Morgan, Piers seems to suggest that Donald Trump was going to be a warmer, fuzzier, and more diplomatic president. Which is something that people have said throughout the last year, but it hasn't really happened. And also, Donald Trump had a massive set piece in the US this week, where he did his first State of the Union after having been in power for a year. And he managed to stick on... He managed to read off an auto cue for about an hour and a half. And people are kind of losing their shit, because they're like, oh my God, finished sentences. This is all bullshit, right? And how do we stop the media from having such a low bar of entry to his ability to finish sentences and to actually read?
Well, if he behaves like an idiot and then every once in a while behaves like a normal person, that is newsworthy. So, as far as stopping the media from...
Oh, you and your, newsworthiness.
I'm sorry, but you know, news organisations do run on novelty. I don't know why this is a surprise to people.
So this happens less in the UK because of impartiality laws, and because I don't think we have that kind of tradition of people giving their personal take. But in the US, an awful lot of the anchors and the people that are meant to be holding him to account were basically fawning over him because of the fact that it was just a normal speech. And I find that really curious in terms of like how the UK would not be kind of saying that. I don't know. It's obvious that we aren't going to see a warmer and fuzzier and more diplomatic politics, because that's what people suggested after his inauguration, and he's basically brought us to the brink of nuclear war about 7 times. But yeah, what do you think?
I think it's going to continue to be bad until the next presidential election, and then there's a reasonable chance he'll get kicked out.
Oh, I don't know. I feel like it's not going to happen.
I mean, there's a reasonable chance he'll also get elected, so there is that.
Yay.
But he'll be gone by... Do they have 5-year terms in the US, the president?
Four
years.
How do you not know that?
I can't remember.
Four more years. It's a thing.
Okay, but so we've got 7 more years, including the 7 more years max of Donald Trump as president.
Oh, that's a very long time. I'm well into my 30s at that point, mate. I don't think I'm into that.
Well, sorry, I guess that is what it is. I mean, it seems unlikely he'll get impeached. So I think it's a choice between nuclear war.
Do you think it's unlikely?
Oh, sorry. I think it's reasonably likely he'll get impeached, but he won't get thrown out of office. So impeachment is effectively the charge laid against him by the House of Representatives, and then the Senate has to vote by 2/3 to actually chuck him out of office, and that won't happen, I don't think.
Because Nixon was never actually impeached, he just quit.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But I think... Assuming I'm using the terminology correctly, which is a bit of an assumption, I think Bill Clinton was impeached, but he obviously wasn't thrown out of office. Is that...
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds right. Anyway, there's a two-stage process, and you only need a simple majority in the House of Representatives, so when the Democrats have a simple majority, they probably will impeach him, because there's lots to impeach him for, to be fair.
Yeah, to be fair.
I suppose the only real question is if... I mean, it's the if the various investigations going around him find something genuinely incriminating or massively incriminating, does that actually turn enough Republicans to make a difference? But I don't really know.
Yeah, he's actually at a surprisingly high level. He's at 40% approval at the moment. He hovers around there at the moment.
So what's the calculation that gives the 40% figure?
It's approvals and disapprovals.
So you're saying more people approve of him than disapprove of him, or is it...
No, 40% of Americans approve of him.
Oh, okay. Yeah, gotcha. That's still remarkably high.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Isn't that terrifying? anyway, shall we move on and talk about the Trump on this side of the Atlantic?
Brexit.
Yes, very good. Oh, look, you got the reference.
How good an analogy is that, do you think?
It's a terrible one.
Okay, good. you weren't surprised at all by these forecasts, and you don't seem to care about them.
Correct.
Fair summary.
Excellent, we'll move on. So what I don't understand is we had... It's actually incredibly infuriating. We had almost these exact figures predicted by economists before the election. The only economic group that didn't predict this and predicted that we'd grow by 4% was... Do you want to guess the name of the economic group, Jimmy?
That predicted we would grow rather than shrink.
Yes, yeah. Go on.
Is it
after
the
Brexit?
IEA?
No. It's economists for something. What do you think they were for?
For Britain?
No. Something else?
for Brexit.
Yeah, it was that on the nose. Economists for Brexit were the only major economic forum that predicted that we would increase in size economically after Brexit. So, great, good for them.
Hmm.
Everybody else predicted between, like, 0.5 and, like, 10%. Shrinkage in growth, so not like actual recession, but a reduction in the rate of the economy growing. And these papers, these kind of forecasts for Brexit scenarios from the government, seem to, surprise surprise, be saying the same thing, because these are probably the same people and the same people from the same schools and the same schools of thought that gave us the predictions before the EU referendum. So they say that the three possible Brexit scenarios, as I was saying in the introduction, are no deal, which would reduce our growth by 8%. If we got a comprehensive free trade agreement, so like people are talking about Canada plus, whatever, this would reduce our growth by 5%. And if we were to have a soft Brexit, so similar to Norway, for example, that would reduce our growth by 2%. And then subsequent trade deals that we had with the USA, for example, would only increase our growth by 0.2%. And then further trade deals with trading blocs like China, India, Australia, and like Gulf nations would only add 0.1 to 0.4% to our economic growth.
Right.
I'm frustrated because people are like, oh my god, this is new information, and I'm like, oh my god, anybody who has a brain knew this.
I mean, is it not significant that the fact that these leaked forecasts, which were first leaked on BuzzFeed, which is interesting.
Is that interesting anymore? I was thinking this. Is the fact that BuzzFeed breaks stuff now a story? I don't know.
It's interesting to me that whoever leaked it, who I'm assuming came from somewhere in the government, chose to give it to BuzzFeed rather than anyone else.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what that means. I just think it's a slightly odd thing.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually.
I mean, it's worth pointing out that, like, I'm not saying this happened this time around, but in the cases of the parliamentary expenses scandal years ago, it was the Telegraph that eventually broke the story, but the details were actually shopped around a couple of newspapers before the Telegraph agreed to buy them, I think. So, yeah, just... I don't know if that applies in this case. Anyway, like, is it not significant that these have come... These are the government's analysis rather than analysis from different sort of external third-party organisations.
But we also had government analysis before the referendum as well. And I'm not sure what else... Like, we have... All we have now in terms of economic data is... And, like, how the economy has changed since... is. From the vote to the triggering of Article 50, and then from Article 50 to now. And it, in economic terms, that is not enough time to figure out what's actually going to happen, to have really very much more information than what we had before the referendum. Actually, in fact, the economy is doing a lot better than people were predicting after voting to leave the European Union, though some people are suggesting that that is because the global economy is doing a lot better than people predicted. And so that's kind of masking the wider effect of like a slower growth of the economy.
Yeah, so there's actually a Kamal Ahmed, the BBC economics editor, article. Where he sort of goes through the Brexit forecasts, and he talks about how, for instance, before the Brexit vote took place, people predicted that after the referendum happened, so not after Brexit happened, but after the referendum happened, and we voted leave, they predicted that unemployment would rise, consumer confidence would collapse, and we'd actually go into a recession rather than just suffer kind of worse growth than we did. And obviously those things didn't turn out to be true. But I don't know, I mean, even some people are using that to say, oh well, you were wrong, you know, the experts were wrong about the Brexit vote, presumably they're going to be wrong about Brexit itself. And even though I think that's mistaken for, I mean, the forecasts are a lot more complicated than that. I do think that probably that lends weight to your argument that actually people will probably just interpret more forecasts as being from the same people that got it wrong the previous time.
I mean, so they're not necessarily going to be from exactly the same people, but these are going to be the same people who are employed, who are from the same universities, who are from the same traditions, who are trained in the same way as everybody, as the people who produced the reports. And so they obviously, the reason that they're the only outlier in any of those reports that were published before the EU referendum, the only outlier was the one from, frankly, the Brexit loonies, is because everybody else basically applied the same kind of model and predicted basically the same thing. And we've gotten the same thing here because they've applied, again, very similar models. But also, this is being seen as like a big victory and like a big gotcha of the government. But I'm like, this argument, when I look at like my fellow Remainers and people who are trying to stop it, I'm like, this argument didn't work beforehand. This isn't, we didn't have a deficit of, or like a scarcity of,
economic data.
Of economic data, right? And of economic predictions. We lost it on like the emotional side of things, right? This isn't the kind of stuff that is going to change people's minds and change people's minds to vote a different way if there were to be a way of like reversing it. And that's what I find really frustrating about this whole thing. What about you, Jimmy? Because you're like a Brexiter who acknowledged, I just want to remind everybody, it's your fault. You're a Brexiter who, you acknowledge that there would probably be a financial hit, but you were like, in the long term, it was worth it.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, cool.
Yep, that's still my position. the thing is that there was an Evening Standard editorial that presumably was written or dictated or orchestrated by George Osborne, who's now Theresa May's bête noire. Mm-hmm. saying that governments are not supposed to knowingly engage in acts of self-harm, in this case economic self-harm.
What, like asking the UK to vote on whether or not it's going to stay in the EU? Fucking tit.
I mean, to be fair, George Osborne was opposed to that.
What are the pot kettle fucking black, what the bloody hell.
But actually in politics, governments knowingly engage in acts of self-harm all the time when they engage in trade-offs. And presumably on some level, not that I regard like the current government as unusually principled, but I'm sure that Theresa May genuinely believes that because the referendum went the way it did, she now has a duty to carry that out in some form.
I also 100% believe that narrative about her.
Yes.
And like her whole, when you hear interviews of her, even before she was Prime Minister, she is very much somebody who has like an idea of duty and all of that lovely, wholesome stuff. She's a vicar's daughter, after all.
She's certainly more principled than David Cameron, I would say.
In that she has some.
Yes. David Cameron had very negotiable principles, I would say. Might be a slightly nice way of putting it. But yeah, I think it's I don't think it's necessarily irresponsible for them to continue with Brexit, even though they think it's going to do economic damage any more than doing any policy like sometimes has downsides.
But then it's like, do you think that they have a duty, in which case, to reduce the amount of damage done as much as possible, and therefore go for a soft Brexit, which has the lowest impact?
So there's this whole argument, which is kind of a paternalistic one, which does the public know what's good for it, is a rough way of summarising it. And the soft Brexit argument is, okay, well, we've definitely lost the EU membership thing in and of itself, but maybe we can gainsay them on some of the details. And I'd kind of just revert to the previous thing, which is I just don't see how single market membership and membership of the customs union and adherence to all ECJ rulings, European Court of Justice rulings, really respects the spirit of the referendum. Like, mm-hmm. that just doesn't really tally for me. I can see why there's some ambiguity around it, but to me that sounds a lot like EU membership lite, and I think I would still go with the idea that if you're going to overrule, you know, the referendum result, you should do it full-throatedly and actually just cancel Brexit altogether.
Well, one can dream.
Are we done with Brexit for the time being?
Well, until next week, I guess.
Is Brexit done with you, is the real question.
Brexit will never be done with me, not until I win.
Okay.
Sorry, was that a bit...
I'm not really sure what that means. speaking of things that are mysterious in their meaning, Jazza, how do you feel about darts?
I've won a darts competition before. I'm actually quite good, apparently.
Okay. So you're pro darts, you would say?
I'm pro playing darts.
You're not pro watching in the darts, pub. Then?
No, it's a very boring sport to watch. It's probably why they have the scantily clad women.
So I've previously caught clips of professional darts, which is sort of...
And it didn't suck you in. You weren't gripped.
So it's a load of old fat pub boars who, admittedly, you know, are presumably really good at what they do. But, you know, sort of...
Oh, who are phenomenal.
Really good at throwing little bits of
wood. But also are going to die of diabetes soon.
Also that, potentially. And then as they sort of, go on, a professional... I don't even know how to describe it. They go on a professional stage. There's, pub benches where people are just sitting there having drinks and stuff. It's a really... It's a weird sport. And I noticed, this was years ago, but I noticed, the, as you put it, scantily clad females that were accompanying them on stage. And even though I think I'm going to come at this whole issue from a different point of view to you, I think it's pretty weird, and I think it's actually kind of sleazy.
I'm really, really enjoying that you're putting a disclaimer at the beginning of this topic.
I think it's weird, but then, there's a lot of things that I don't think are good, and I still think that people should be allowed to do them. What's your position on this first? I feel you should...
Can you just lay out your interpretation of what has happened?
So basically what's happened is, as we summarised properly at the start of this podcast, the main darts competition, PDC, has decided it will no longer employ walk-on girls, who are the scantily clad females that we just mentioned, to accompany darts players.
And to be fair, they aren't always scantily clad. Some they're off, in cocktail dresses, essentially, some of the time.
Yeah, cocktail
but
dresses.
But it can range from bikini to cocktail dress.
I wouldn't. It's not. They're not dresses you wear to church, I think you could safely say. Just to... Maybe you would. So I don't know what sort of church that.
Completely depends on the church. There's a lot of modern interpretations of Christianity these days, Jimmy.
So I mean, the thing is, I've listened to a couple of interviews now. There was a what's the show with Philip Schofield and Holly Willoughby?
This morning.
There was a clip there where I'm going to say a feminist journalist. She's not.
Her name was Sally Howard.
You've seen this as well.
Yeah.
She debated with two walk-on girls or former walk-on girls who just lost their jobs. Because
called Charlotte
decision.
Wood and Daniela Alfrey. I've deliberately written down their names so that they aren't just the walk-on girls. I want to humanise them.
And they
virtue signal.
But they the walk on girls whose names I've already forgotten.
Charlotte and Danny
defend their they say that they don't find it demeaning, that they enjoy the work, that everyone's always really pleasant to them, that they don't get harassed, which, you know, all sounds good. And then was it Sally
Howard?
Sally Howard. She then says, well, actually, it's demeaning to women on the whole, and it's an outdated practice, and it's sexist, and it should be banned or put to bed, at least.
Mm-hmm.
Are you with Sally on this?
I think that all three women are correct, actually.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah, so I think the important thing that we say is, because a lot of the heat online has been about the fact that this has been banned. It hasn't been banned. They've made a business decision.
Yeah.
They've made a business decision because, as you said, Jimmy, it's a little bit weird. And I think that also Sally Howard, the writer on that debate, made a really good point that this was actually... It was very deliberately a ploy in the 1990s because so few people were watching darts competitions. And so it was a way of trying to get more people, more eyeballs on, because it was something to gawk at. And I think that, on a whole, it is, demeaning to women. And it is something that is outdated and makes an awful lot of people feel uncomfortable. But also I don't begrudge people being able to do this if they want to. And I think that this is somewhere the thing is Charlotte and Danny, the two walk-on girls, they were talking about the fact that they were protected by like four bodyguards when they walked up on stage. They never felt that they were pressured to do anything, and it was always very they always felt very respected and really cared for, and they felt like part of the family. I think that's actually brilliant. The thing is, we're in an environment at the moment on the back of like the Harvey Weinstein stuff, and on the back of In the Shadow of the President's Club, where there were a handful of public figures and politicians who were going to these all male parties where women. Why are you laughing at this?
I'm just laughing at a gay guy criticizing all male parties.
They were
slightly scoffing tone.
They weren't my kind of all male parties, Jimmy.
Okay, so all male parties aren't necessarily wrong, unless it's straight guys.
Well, no, it was an all male party where women who were there to work were being groped and being told to wear scantily
clad things.
That is bad.
I'm just there appears to have been a general condemnation of all male parties, which I think is a bit silly. You know, given, I mean, there are some people literally on I was reading on Twitter. We should stop referring to Twitter, but I'm going to do it now. We're saying like,
oh, it's a fantastic source.
So I think I'm not going to name her because I'm not sure it was her, but somebody said, oh, all male events are really bad. And someone was like, but what about gay events? And she was like, oh, they're fine. And it's like, if people want to go to single sex events, that is fine. But also groping is not good. So we should be able to understand those as two distinct points, I think.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
The thing is, a lot of the time, women end up being... even if they are people who have chosen this kind of work, women end up being forced into this work, being paid... Not forced into, but through their circumstances, through the fact that have lost jobs or are trying to support people in their families and stuff like that, find themselves in these types of work, and find themselves in unstable work where they aren't valued, where they don't really have a lot of rights as workers, and their body is the only thing that they are kind of valued for in that actual workplace. There was actually one of the tweets that you sent me from a journalist that transcribed an interview.
That's Martin Daubney.
Yeah, thank you. So he transcribed a conversation with, oddly, between a yoga teacher and a walk-on girl, was it?
Yes,
I wasn't sure what
correct.
The context was.
Yeah, it was on the Jeremy Vine show.
But the with the walk-on girl, the lady, she was saying that... the yoga teacher was saying, oh, I believe that people should be able to get an education and get better jobs than this. And the walk-on girl said, oh, but I have 5 A-levels, but I had to care for my mum, so this was the only work that I could get. And I was like, yeah, exactly. Like, you had no choice and had to go into this work, and fantastic, you were able to find a job that paid you some money. But the whole thing, I think, makes me feel very, very uncomfortable.
I suppose it's... this is kind of why I wanted to discuss this, is that there's a kind of theoretical liberal position in favour of... this is kind of a form of sex work. Not exactly, but do you know what I mean? It's like at the very bottom end of the...
It's in the same vein, right?
Yeah, in the same ballpark, as Americans would say. And
is that an American thing, or is that not just English?
I don't think so. I think ballpark is like baseball. Anyway, it's in the same ballpark anyway. And I guess the trouble is that, while theoretically... not even theoretically, there are some people that have other options and choose to do sex work, right? They actively choose to do that. But there's something a little bit more troubling about it when people are basically being... forced into it through circumstance, I suppose, or desperation.
Right. Yeah. No. I 100% agree, and I advocate for sex work being legalized.
Yeah.
Because you end up with safer circumstances for both the people who want to purchase that kind of service and for the people who provide that kind of service. It is a no-brainer for me. What I think is particularly worrying about this type of, if we're going to call it sex work, is the fact that it is kind of like a nudge-nudge, wink-wink. We know why the girls are there. We know that the girls are there to be looked at. We know that the girls are there to be objectified. And granted, in the majority of the cases... perhaps, or in a lot of cases, the girls are going to be safe and they're going to feel safe and they're not going to feel pressured. But the fact is, it has set that precedent for that girl to be an object, for that young woman to be an object. And that's what... but it's kind of dressed up as it's glamour. She's not a topless model on page 3, she's a glamour model. But we know what that actually means. That means that guys get to open the front page of... into the first page of the Sun, and they get to look at some young lady's tits. And that's what it is, and it's actually kind of gross and sordid. But it's kind of dressed up. It's dressed up, right?
Hang on a second. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely dressed up. I mean, glamour modelling is kind of, it's a form of soft pornography, basically.
So call it porn. But people are kidding themselves that this is like it's something like nice and glamorous and like
I don't think it should be considered sordid just because it happens to be straight men looking at women.
When is that kind of situation in mainstream media ever presented for any other group?
I mean, I suppose lesbians could look at page 3.
Find me a fucking lesbian that is into page 3.
All right, if anyone knows who's listening knows of a
please
lesbian
who's no tweet us. We'd love to have you on.
Yeah, I mean, fair point, but like, I'm just saying that there seems to be a general kind of distaste for male or straight male sexuality at this point.
Do you understand why, though?
Yeah, no, I understand that there is something slightly predatory about heterosexual men. Or at least,
I mean, also men in general, right? Like, I've been on the receiving end of men being predatory and twats.
I mean, it's not exclusive. It's just that seems to be mostly where that kind of... In terms of the sense that sexuality is predatory, it appears to be more focused on straight men than any other type of group, which... I don't know, is possibly justified in terms
Is that not because that's the in terms of absolute numbers, that's where the majority of predatory sexual behaviour comes from? Is from
probably
straight men.
Yeah, it probably does. So in that sense, I think it's fair enough. But I don't. The thing is, I don't think. I don't really have a problem with actually people attaching soft pornography to sports events, but. You do need to be kind of honest about what it is you're doing, I think. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe, there's something dishonest about dressing it up as like a quote, a bit of glamour or whatever else. And I do, I think the thing is that, yeah, sure, sex work theoretically can just be like any other type of work, but in practice, I don't, and in terms of how people feel about themselves, in terms of the psychological impact on the people who have to do that work, I don't think it's like other types of work. And mm-hmm. I think it's reasonable to make some accommodation for that in how it's discussed and how it's actually treated.
Do you want to talk about the Brendan O'Neill article?
I thought we just... Do you want to summarise the Brendan O'Neill article then?
Well, he says...
This was for The Spectator, right?
Yeah, Brendan O'Neill is a columnist, is he, at The Spectator?
Yeah.
Who is a troll.
I think he's sincere.
Well, that worries me. He needs to stop writing about women, because he also thinks that the Me Too campaign is just a load of people trying to get attention, but good for him. he actually raised a really interesting case about intersectionality and class in feminism, but funnily enough didn't dress it up in that kind of way. He was saying that, like, a lot of the condemnation of stuff like walk-on girls, or should we say walk-on women? Who knows? I feel uncomfortable saying that. but he was saying that the condemnation of work on walk-on girls was very much a middle-class kind of, like, pastime, middle-class hobby. And the middle-class women who worked for the BBC and wanted to get a pay rise thought that their cause was just and fair. But the women who were trying to earn an honest living by escorting darts players to their crease was... I don't know, like an unjust cause or something like along those lines. I think he's got a really good point about class and intersectionality and feminism, but I don't think that was his point. That was his kind of goal with the article.
So if you wanted to express what you thought he was sort of gesturing at that was correct, what would you actually be saying then?
That working class women often have... very different aspiration. It's the same with a lot of different types of intersectionality when it comes to be it queer rights or women's rights or any minorities' rights. There's lots of like identities that intersect with one another, and he's focused on class at the moment and like economic mobility. And so women who are from perhaps lower classes and from lower socioeconomic sections of society are going to have very different priorities when it comes to equality, quote unquote, than a woman who has been able to go to school, has finished school, gone to get her A levels, going to university, and all of that kind of stuff. Her goals are probably to make sure that she's able to like raise the kids, make sure that she is safe if she has like an abusive partner or something, and all of those kinds of things. And this is like a big criticism with modern day feminism a lot, is that there are a lot of women who are left behind, be they women of colour or non-Western women or poorer women or lower class women. Yeah, I think that is a very good point. So, for example, with the Jeremy Kyle... like to and fro that we quoted earlier on.
You mean Jeremy Vine, rather?
Jeremy
Kyle.
Vine, sorry, not Jeremy Kyle.
Different Vines.
Different Jeremy. Yeah, different ones. Very different vibes. Where the girl was like, yeah, this was a way for me to get money when I was caring for a family member, despite the fact that I got like A stars at school. She doesn't particularly care about whether or not her being a walk-on girl is going to be damaging the feminist cause. All she wants is to make sure that she is able to provide for her family member. That's the most important thing for her, and that is sometimes the problem with feminism is that it leaves women like her behind for the sake of like this wider greater cause.
Well, I think that the
and I think that maybe that was a good point that Brendan O'Neill had. I don't think he particularly meant it though.
I think it was the yoga teacher in that particular interview said I think it was the Jeremy Vine one. Said essentially that, you know, sometimes for the greater good, individuals have to suffer, and in this case, it might have been actually on the This Morning show. Anyway, somebody, one of the two of them, said something to that effect, which I mean, does put it pretty bluntly, I think.
I mean, I think that there is truth to that broadly, but also, if you have these like, it's the same with people of colour, with queer people, and with women. If we're claiming to be these umbrella identities that are trying to lift up everybody who is from our minority, then we'd better well speak for absolutely everybody and not just everyone who has joined the queer society at the university or has joined a feminist, liked a feminist page on Facebook and gone to the Women's March or any of that kind of stuff.
I mean, like, that's ultimately impossible, though, because
it is ultimately impossible. But we don't need to kid ourselves. We shouldn't kid ourselves that this is for everybody.
But I'm saying that within, say, feminism can't speak for all women because all women have different interests and viewpoints and opinions.
Yeah, no, of course, but it can damn well try to. I think that there are general things that can be there are things that can be generalized to all women that most women do end up experiencing in their lives, and I think that's what feminism is trying to change and to justify and to provide justice for, I guess, or to fix.
Well, there's common things to say all women's lives, but you know, even very basic stuff like sort of childbirth or, you know, whatever, like, people have massively different opinions on those things. Like,
stuff like abortion,
yeah, but women have incompatible opinions on those things, so obviously feminism can't speak for all of them.
No, of course they can, but then a lot of the people
they can't, though, can they? If you have two incompatible opinions, then no one source can speak for both of them.
No, but it's very possible for a woman not to be a feminist.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, sure. We've been talking for a very long time. Shall we wrap up? Is there anything else you want to ask?
Yeah, I mean, just to... This does actually trail off your previous point, but I don't... There was this whole dynamic between the This Morning discussion and also the Jeremy Vine discussion, which is the walk-on girls were kind of just expressing, you know, this is my choice, this is my, you know, I've chosen to do this job, I don't feel I've been pressured into it, and it's about individual choice, right? And then on the other hand, you had the kind of The other women were effectively treating it as kind of a broad class kind of interest thing, as in doing this you are representing all women in some way, or you're affecting all women in some way. And I think I don't know that we can necessarily discuss anything in and of itself on that point, but I find that it's very central to actually a lot of modern debate around social justice, is that tension between individual freedom and, you know, the freedom of a particular interest group, or the, sorry, interests of a particular group.
Like for somebody saying that the profession that you have chosen is demeaning, or is damaging to the wider group, but that person still wants to be able to do that thing.
Yeah, basically. I mean, I don't feel that any individual should feel that they're representative of whatever demographic they happen to belong to. And obviously that is something that at least a certain strand of feminism disagrees with me on.
Yeah, I think that there's something there to think about and to talk about at a later date.
All right, shall we wrap this up then?
Yes, I'm very tired.
Okay, you can go get your beauty sleep.
What are you trying to say?
You can think about it as you doze off.
Okay, you can find me at Jazza John. Feel free to come and, you know, hang out. You can find the podcast at Right Dishonor. Check us out on Patreon, because we enjoy getting money, frankly. And Jimmy, you can find at JDE Nichols.
That is true.
Plug the website.
Yeah, we have a website at rightdishonourable.com, which I almost mispronounced there because I'm also tired. And you can also find us on iTunes and leave a review because no one's done that for ages. And that's sad.
Love us.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right, toodly. Bye-bye.